Welcome to Casterbus. It's a Doctor Who episode. This week we're looking at the second of the Doctor Who 60th anniversary specials, Wild Blue Yonder. Joining me, Christian Corley, is James McLean. Hello, James.
Hiya.
And Brian Terranova. Hello, Brian.
Hello, everyone. It's weird to be back.
I mean, you were here a few months ago, in fairness. I think it was last year, wasn't it? We did a podcast with you. So, but it's nice to have you on again.
Was that recent?
I don't know. I feel like it was, but it might not have been. The last few years have obviously been a strange concertina of... it was ages ago. No, it was last week, hasn't it, really? Ever since things happened with people having to work from home and all that sort of thing. So, yeah, it's all very confusing. We're here to talk about the second of the Doctor Who 60th anniversary. Do you know, we were talking about this, weren't we? It doesn't feel like an anniversary to me. The 50th felt like an anniversary. This doesn't.
Is it the stories that are being told, or are you just saying like anniversary? It doesn't feel like an anniversary year.
It doesn't feel like an anniversary year. It doesn't feel big enough.
Hmm. Yeah, you know, I remember we talked, I think I was on the series for this, but I remember talking about the 10-year anniversary for the new series being missed, and we all kind of thought, like, that should be celebrated. They celebrated it for the classic series. And it's not, like, I have nothing wrong with them celebrating the 60th anniversary, but I get what you're saying. It doesn't feel the same.
Yeah,
I don't mind it, though. Like, I don't need to have a big grandiose doctor, a multi-doctor adventure, you know, every anniversary,
in
my opinion.
Yeah, no. We had the last Chris Chibnall, Jodie Whittaker episode, didn't we? So, I mean, it's not...
Right, exactly.
Yeah, it's not necessary. There wasn't one in 1989, for example, or 88, beg your pardon. There wasn't a multi-doctor story for 25, but it doesn't feel big to me. James, does it feel big to you? He says to the man who's just unzipped.
Yeah. Yeah, it feels... It's a little personal. It feels suitably big to me.
Okay.
It feels... I don't quite understand... I mean, is it just that multi-doctor stories feel synonymous with big, but... I don't know. I mean, we've got two Doctors this year. We've had the Daleks released in colour. You know, we've got a Christmas special. We've got documentaries out. There's a lot of stuff around. I think iPlayer, catalogue release. It feels to me like a big celebration. I am a little surprised that it doesn't to you, but I respect that. I'll keep my bigness to myself.
Okay. Well... I mean, I feel there was more of a, I mean, it might be an age thing, it might be an engagement thing. I feel like there was more of a party celebratory atmosphere in 2013 than there is this year, I suppose. But that might just be me, clearly.
Yeah. Yeah.
One of my other friends was talking to me.
Okay.
He was saying that he also doesn't feel like it's an anniversary year, you know, like, To him, though, I gather the feeling is that the story should be like an anniversary of sorts. There should be a multi-doctor. They should be celebrating the aliens and the creatures throughout the show, or the stories, or the writers, or characters, companions. And I get that. I understand that feeling. To many people, that's how an anniversary for a TV show like this is supposed to feel. And like you had noted, in Jodie's era, they did do that. They brought back Doctors already. So if you did it again so soon, I kind of feel like it would just kind of, the novelty would wear off, kind of thing, in my opinion. So I don't know. I like it. I did, Big Finish just announced that it's almost 50 years of the Santarans. And wow. That would have been a neat thing to kind of couple. Hey, here's celebrating 60 years of Doctor Who, but 50 years of the Santarans. Why don't we tell a grand Santaran story as well? That would have been fun for me, but... Just me personally, I don't know about anybody else.
So we're going to have a chat about Wild Blue Yonder, in which the Doctor and Donna, obviously in a coffee-inspired incident, travel to the edge of the known universe, and the TARDIS HADS system kicks in, and they're left stranded in what is essentially a two-piece, a 60-minute two-piece, four-piece, I suppose, in some ways. But basically, there's two people in the entire show until the very end. I enjoyed this episode. Let's just start this off. I enjoyed this episode. I was not impressed with the beginning of the episode, because it seems to be a kind of scenario whereby the writers Russell T Davies in this case. He's not the only one who's ever done this. Who's introduced something which causes a bit of a fuss and then brings some, you know, it feels like it's for publicity and it feels a bit cynical to me. Now, I'm talking about the casting of a half-Indian actor to play Sir Isaac Newton. Isaac Newton, who was very much a pasty ginger Cornish man in real life. And it just feels to me like... And then you've got the Apple business and the clear off out of our tree, Tom Baker. I like the Mavity gag. It just feels to me that it's giving an opportunity for people to just kind of dump on things when actually the rest of the episode is a really strong episode.
Yeah, I mean, I get where you're going with that. I would say I enjoyed the Mavity joke of it. But for me, the intro, I agree with you, is the only thing I didn't like about the episode, but only because it felt like one of those Moffat unnecessary intros. Like, this story should have... It actually, like, I feel the intro was more so there, and I think other people have said this online, so that you can imagine that the Doctor and Donna have crash landed in multiple places prior to landing on that ship, so that, you know, Big Finish or books or whatever can tell multiple stories rather than just these three adventures truly meeting on right after each other. But for me, it fell flat because it was like, you know what? If the ship had just crashed on that spaceship and the only things we saw the whole time, and this story truly was a two-hander, was just the Doctor and Donna. And I've been avoiding spoilers. I've been avoiding trailers. Yeah. The only thing I truly have been seeing has been like photos that the BBC release here or there. And just because if you use Twitter or you use Instagram or whatever, you can't avoid them. And so I saw all the photos and it was just the Doctor and Donna. And I was hoping that this story would be a two-hander and I was not let down.
No.
But that intro... I just felt like I was watching the Moff era again, and that's what kind of took me down. And you know, there are fans of that era. I don't mean to make that sound negative, but there were just things in that era that I felt were like, why did we do this? What was the point of this? Because it literally went nowhere aside from the Mavity joke. Now there's one more story. Maybe it'll pay off. I don't know. But it was there literally just to set up a joke in an otherwise kind of dark episode, which I guess... you need a little bit of a lightness in that.
Yeah, I think what Brian said at the end is pretty much the reason. I think it was to just give it a little bit of light from what otherwise was quite a dark and sort of give it a bit more pep for where it was going. I think that was why it was there. I mean, I've got to the point now where I think anyone we do historical is not accurate to the history. In fact, the majority of our historical dramas, for whatever reasons, either miscast or... whether it be age, whether it be in regionality, whether it be... nothing is accurate. And so I kind of don't mind it anymore. I think I can sort of see a position where there's a sort of argument of like, if the actor kind of fits and they've got the right sort of rhythm that we want for it, let's do it. I think it's less about the notions that we've especially had in the 2010s about box ticking. I think it's more about casters and producers having a free reign to pick someone they really like and they want to do in that part, particularly maybe also because they might have a certain capital as well. Let's cast them, and let's just don't give a damn about, you know, the issues of color or what people say, because this is what we want to do. It feels a lot of this stuff these days, I don't think, is the box ticking. I think it's a lot about creative empowerment, where the people who are creative just want to have fun and do things in certain ways, and they just don't want the restrictions anymore. And I suppose the streaming age has given them that. It's given them that space to be able to break down some of those boundaries, which I get for some people can throw them out of the moment. I do understand that, and I think that's a valid criticism. I didn't bother. The thing that got me a little bit with it was... I found, and in a couple bits in the episode, I found this was the FFX just kind of felt a little, not ropey, but just a little off.
It felt the probe, I thought, was quite good, but it did feel, the design of it did feel a little bit Star Wars video game.
There was just some, I mean, we'll probably talk about when they get onto the station, but just even in this beginning bit, the box flying off and the box flying into the tree felt really 2008. It just didn't feel like there was any sense of distance, you know, in terms of like the depth. Like, I don't know, I'm not really watched it yet, but the sort of like color, it felt like that box coming into the tree and coming out felt like it was on exactly the same plane. The color didn't shift, or, you know, there was, as you say, there was no depth there.
Yeah.
Invisibility. Maybe I'm going crazy, but for whatever reason, it didn't work. And I was like, ouch, that's a bit ouchy after such a very tight previous episode. But then I think, I mean, especially when you see the behind the scenes of it, which I did watch after for once, you know, the amount of technology which is, you know, driven into these stories now, and they are kind of big things. I don't mind them occasionally being a little off on the effects, because I think that probably means the show is pushing more than it should.
Yeah.
And maps where it should be. It should be trying to push boundaries, not being safe. But yeah, there was a couple of times where I was like, ooh, but yeah, I know what you mean. And I like the gag in that opening section where she sort of says, have you got the TARDIS switch to famous or whatever? Because there is always that bit as well. And I suppose if we were to get in-depth argument, one of my family had sort of said, you know, I'm not sure I like this because it's constant. We're constantly taking the agency out of every historical figure. If every historical figure has eventually been influenced by this one person, and it's not just sort of rambly jokes that Tom Baker says that you don't know are true or not, but you're actually seeing he legitimately influences every major player in history. I don't know. Does the gag suddenly become? And it was the same with the Davros gag as well, obviously, as well with the, you know, the name Dalek. How far before the gag actually starts to feel like you're eroding away the scale of history? But
yeah, okay,
no, that's very valid, because I've thought the same, right? Like the show is, you know, originally was showing you like how great human beings are and so on, and then here everything. It goes back to kind of like some of the stuff put forth in the Chibnall era that, you know, we talked about before, where everybody basically is a version of the Doctor. Like that's kind of what they postulated in that era. So basically the Doctor created everything and is everyone. And it's like, that's a bit too much. I'd like to dial the show back down to reality a little bit more. I mean, it's so fanciful. You got to have some level of reality for me.
I'm going to read the description of the episode from Wikipedia, and then I'm going to read something else, and then see if anyone notices anything similar. The TARDIS crash lands on a spaceship at the edge of the known universe. Sensing hostile action, the TARDIS dematerializes, stranding the Doctor and Donna, who begin exploring the ship, finding it abandoned. After locating the bridge, they are confronted by a pair of unknown entities from outside the known universe, taking the forms of imperfect copies of the Doctor and Donna. So, you know, they're shape-shifting. After a series of interactions, the Doctor figures out that the creatures are attempting to use them as a way to reach the known universe, and they learn by forcing their targets to act quickly and impulsively. They discover that the ship's captain initiated an extremely delayed self-destruct sequence before killing herself to prevent the entities from taking control of the ship. The Doctor speeds up the self-destruct sequence, and the TARDIS returns, allowing the Doctor and Donna to escape while the entities are destroyed. Returning to the alley from which they departed, they encounter Wilfred, who tells them that the world is ending and asks for the Doctor's help. Now, you know, fine summary. I think that pretty much covers everything. But I'm very interested in the TARDIS crash lands on a spaceship at the edge of the known universe. They are confronted by unknown entities who shapeshift, and then the Doctor and Donna escape. Ryan, did any of that sound familiar to you?
Oh, interesting. Offhand, I mean, having them land at the end of a universe, it does sound familiar. I'm going to Underworld, but I don't have shape-shifting in there.
No.
Which is weird, because I've got another story, by the way, that I was going to bring up, so I'm very curious which one you're going with, and I'll probably feel stupid for missing it.
Yeah, you will. I'm talking about Time Leech Part 2.
Oh my god! Oh my god! You're so right.
Yeah, the Doctor and companion land on a spaceship at the edge of the known universe with a low temperature, artificial gravity. They encounter shape shifting creatures and they leg it before everything is destroyed. Basically.
Wow! This is the second time. Oh my god!
It keeps happening.
Wow.
Yeah, that's weird, isn't it? So anyway, there is a similarity with Underworld, but what's the other story?
So for me, it's one that I don't think every Doctor Who fan would get. But when I said that I was hoping this would be a two-hander, it was because two-handers, to me, they're great. You really get to let your leads shine, right? Yeah. They get to just they get to show their acting prowess in unimaginable ways that you couldn't do when you have a full ensemble cast, or largely you can't do. And the reason I liked that so much is because there was a big Finnish Doctor Who play called Scherzo, where the Eighth Doctor and Charlie were stuck, not in the edge of the universe, but they were stuck at the edge of reality, between our universe and another universe where time didn't exist. Ooh. But in this universe, it was just the two of them. Now, it wasn't a spaceship. It was a white void where sometimes all they could see is white and sometimes they could see nothing. But in that void, a creature was born from the two of them. At first, it was just a voice. That was them, and kind of like repeating things to them. And then it became an entity, and they were more, they themselves, Charlie and the Doctor, were morphing into one. Like they would hold hands and realize that no longer were they holding hands, but their hands were together as one. They were now one entity and so on. So there was a lot, as I was watching the story, I was like, wow, like he was either inspired by this or heard it and, you know, it just left an impression in his mind and didn't think about it, or somehow just magically they are so very similar.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Mm, yeah. That, and that's Scherzo, which came out in 2003. Wow. Years ago. 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought it felt kind of fresh. Like Brian, I intentionally didn't know anything about the episode.
Yeah. No,
so
same here.
I went in totally clean. Well, that's cool. And it was enjoyable for that. Even knowing that it was just the two would have been... could have sort of, I don't know, started to start you, because when you get a basic framework, you start mapping out, you can't help it, intuitively start mapping out where this is going to go. But if you don't know whether they're even going to meet like a load of colonists or a pilot or if there's an alien monster of the week, you don't know anything. It's a far more enjoyable, especially an episode like this, where the whole idea is that you explore the space as they explore it.
Yeah.
So you have no idea what's outside that room when they land. You know, you don't know it's going to be a corridor. You don't know if it's going to be a colony. That made it for a very enjoyable experience. I thought it was interesting that, I think we talked about this last time, that leading up, that they'd sort of, Davis and Tennant had sort of kind of bigged this up and said it's like something you've never seen before. Which obviously the two of you have kind of suggested perhaps that's not entirely accurate. It certainly felt fresh, in but without seeming not fresh.
Yeah,
you know, I've seen
yeah.
people on the internet compare it to ones like Midnight, for instance.
Sure.
Those sort of standalone, for those sure. kind of bottly sort of things with just, you know, limited cast. But I thought it was pretty good. I think one thing I did like about it, really minor thing, there's a couple of things that might be worth talking about here.
Okay.
Was going back like a year ago now. Would it have been a year ago? I suppose it would have been with
might
Flux.
Have been. That was 2 years ago.
And was it 2 years ago?
Yeah.
Oh, good Lord. And we were always talking about whether she actually repaired the Flux in the end of Flux. We always thought it was kind of not quite clear whether the Flux had kind of been repaired by it being removed. And here it's sort of very clearly underlined that the Flux did not get repaired, and half the universe, assumedly around the 21st century, is now missing.
Yeah.
I thought that was, and again, Davis looking to use this to sort of pile on a little more of that sort of Time Lord angst, which I'm sure many old viewers of Doctor Who back in the 2000s who were all complaining about him being too angsty and too, at the time, the term emo was always coming up. We'll be now enjoying the return to a doctor with baggage. That doctor they've been clamoring for the last 3-4 years is back, and he's got baggage. So I thought that was interesting. I wasn't expecting the Flux to have actually wiped out half the universe, and I wonder if that's going to be a thing moving on. And also by default as well, this suggestion that, much I know to both of your chagrin, the Timeless Child thing still kind of feels like it's in the mix. It's clearly that Davis doesn't really want to push on that. He's got other buttons to push, but that is still there too. So it's interesting in that sort of, because there's a lot of people who've kind of misunderstood the fact that this is series one, that they to mean that this is a reboot show, that they're going to try and ignore the past rather than the fact that Bad Wolf Productions has taken it on and it's their production. So it's now series one of their production order rather than it being like the ongoing as before. I've seen some debates about like that, sort of like, is this, you know, just did none of that happen now? And people go, well, obviously it did because we've got Donna here. You know, it's still continuity.
Shuri's era is going to be season one, right? Not this one. This one's not season one.
Yeah, that's how I understood it as well.
Series one for Shuri is going to start. To James's note, when I heard the bit about the Timeless Child and the Flux and so on, I think maybe we did do a podcast on the Flux or something, because I remember talking about this. I actually liked most of Flux. I don't like the Timeless Child aspect, and I've been vocal on this before. I don't like the Timeless Child storyline. However, having David bring it up and having them show the angst, as you said, that like he's going through, look, they made me destroy half of the universe. I don't know if I'm truly from Gallifrey or any of this stuff. I actually don't mind that, because that shows that these things truly did happen to the Doctor and that he's in this state right now where he didn't open, you know, Jodie didn't open the watch, didn't find out, is this true? Is this not true? So right now it's a bit of a Schrodinger's cat kind of thing. And I think they should kind of leave it there. Right. Because I think it's a great way to be. If you sit there and you turn around and you 100% say the Timeless Child is real, then you're going to annoy the fans who really don't like there being a Doctor before Hartnell. Right. But if you say that it's not real, then you're going to annoy the fans that love Ruth and love all the other Doctors and maybe there or the implications that story has. And I think if you stay in that sweet spot right in the middle where the Doctor's just, man, I don't know who I am anymore. I don't know what my life really is. All I know is all these bad things happened. Then you get the best of both worlds. People like myself who, aren't really keen on the Timeless Child get to sit there and I can think, hey, don't worry. I don't believe this is real. But I understand that the Doctor is in a dark spot right now, not having any idea. And all those other fans out there that do like the Timeless Child, they get to sit there and go, well, this is great. It is real. Maybe the Doctor will come to terms with that one day. I think we're in that kind of like perfect area. I see no reason to ignore what came before, but I would personally like it to stay on that edge of, is it real? Is it not real?
I mean, I personally prefer the whole idea of not giving a damn about the past and the origins of the Doctor. You know, I've said this repeatedly over the years. I was saying this when you were on the podcast regularly, Brian. Doctor Who kind of gets stuck in a rut being with the Doctor as the focus, and it was always better in terms of getting the Doctor into stuff when the focus was on the bad guy, when the bad guy was the main character of an episode. And these days, the only time you get that really is with the classic villains. You don't get a monster of the week who's never been seen before. You don't get that being the focus of the episode. And we don't get those big bad guys anymore, which is very... very sad, because over the years, lots of good actors who have been cast in villainous roles have kind of not really had much of the episode because of that approach of focusing on the Doctor and the companion rather than focusing on the villain. So we don't get, you know, we don't get the performances like Solon in Brain of Morbius, or you've got Boss and Stevens in The Green Death, or there's countless examples of it. You've got, your big actors playing big villainous roles, and the Monster of the Week thing, and the Villain of the Week thing, and now it's always Doctor and Companion's Thing of the Week thing, and which always shapes the direction of the episode. And the antagonists don't have the same sort of power and agency in the modern series as they had in the past, in the classic series. And I'm not saying it should be exactly like that anymore, but I would just like to see a bit more from them and a bit less of the, what? How does a Doctor feel about shit this week? You know?
I definitely would like to see more of a focus on the villains and the threats and the threat at hand. You're right. Like, they do always change it to an emotional center. And that kind of started, obviously, as far back as Russell starting series one. But I do miss just having an adventure that was a good old-fashioned adventure that, like, there is danger here and we have to stop the adventure. I would love to see more of that. I think maybe a good mix of both is truly what would make a lot of sense. So I'm with you on that, because it is a little bit sad. And I do think, like we talked about this before, especially with like the Moth era, where there would be a plot line, alien is here to destroy the world. And you'd think that would take up the full 45 minutes or whatever, but instead it was the doctor and the companions having some kind of emotional struggle or battle with themselves. And then in the last 10 seconds, that's right, there's an alien thing. Let's stop that. Oh, it's done. Yeah. And that's where I would get turned off quite a bit because, you know, my attraction to Doctor Who has always obviously been about the characters and the fancifulness of the story and so on, but it's also those villains and the stories and how the Doctor and the companions overcome that villainy and that story, or the friends they make along the way kind of thing. And I can handle the drama and I like the drama, and good stories can still tackle both. But I do agree with what you're saying. Like it is sad to see those kind of elements disappear. Like we're losing... I can't remember the last memorable villain, actually, now that you're even saying that.
I like the idea that there's...
I can't go back and think of one.
I like the idea that there's episodes listening to this at the moment, and they're all listening, and Power of Three is going, is he talking about me? Is he talking about me?
Episodes of Doctor Who Andrew listening
is going, I think it's you again, mate. It's you. Is it me again? Are they ragging on me again? Yeah. Good reason too, says Kay's Van Tran. You just not got it. You know, you're just an awkward child, mate.
Let's flip.
I'd have to say I don't totally agree. I mean, I do agree, as I think we've said many times in the past over the years, that there has been a lack of strong, interesting villains that aren't just repeat villains. I agree with that. I don't have too much issue of the baggage. In some sense, I prefer it, because to me, one of the problems the show's had, and we've talked about this many times, is that you have companions who end up using this as a roller coaster ride. It's the backpack across Europe, the coming of age, you know, freeing from the teams, exploring the world sort of analogy. And yet, really, they're exploring various different conflicts and wars where people are dying and terrible things are happening, and they seem to be getting off on that. And that always feels a bit weird. So I kind of like the moments where you get, where, like, for instance, for now, at this moment, suddenly the Flux actually has some weight to it. Now, when I go back and watch the Flux and I see the end of that, that will be a far darker ending, a far more interesting ending than if, oh, well, it's sorted and everything's back to normal, which is kind of how it felt. But now there's a kind of feeling like, yeah, there's stuff there that has had meaning. That is a terrible thing to have happened. And, you know, it's good to see our heroes actually recognize that.
Yeah.
Or at least one of them did.
Well, yeah, yeah.
Obviously, Yaz was unbothered and the rest, but yeah. I'd like to see that more. But I know what you mean. I don't want to see it dominate. I like it. I liked it this week because I kind of wanted those moments in that episode where I just felt like we just need to slow down for a second. These two people have not met in years.
Yeah.
Hundreds of years for one of them.
Well, that's billions for one of them.
The audience, when you just, if we take the, I don't agree with that. I always think that's a ridiculous postulation of Moffat. It's multiple billions iterations. Heaven Sent. Is it Heaven Sent?
Yeah,
to me, it's millions of years of iterations of him trying to get through the wall rather than a singular memory of a million billions of years. That's just ridiculous.
I agree with that.
But yeah, the point being, I think it's good to see that. And we wanted to see some sort of emotional moment for them just to stop and talk. And we got that, but it wasn't too much that the story kept moving along. And I think you've got to find that balance, which I'm sorry, Power of Three, you just didn't find.
No,
you just have to handle that. You've had a moment and you blew it.
Yeah. No. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, that's Power of Three. You're right on Heaven Sent. It is like the doctor that gets there and then walks through. He's just got there and does the thing for the day, then punches it and walks through. So, yeah, it's only a day, really. But there's all those other ones that took billions of years ahead of that. But anyway, let's get back to Wild Blue Yonder. You said it was dark. And I guess, yes, it was dark, but I was laughing throughout. the big hands.
That's kind of what we were saying. It needs to have some elements to make you laugh because of the darkness they were going to. Because it was creepy. Those the villain he created in this story, the villains were good and creepy.
Yeah, yeah, no, yeah. I enjoyed.
But that was their.
But the big hand.
That was their performance, wasn't it? I mean, I didn't find them more creepy standing behind the glass than I did when they had the prosthetic teeth in their mouths. It was the actual performance of the actors which carried the creepiness rather than the actual hands or the teeth or anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the
and I loved like the little moments that got me were when the doctor removed his tie and said, there, you know, like if we see the other one, they won't have a tie. And then, and you know, Donna points that out. And I love the realization on his face when he was like, oh, when you remove things, they're still there. Like that kind of, you can see them figuring things out, which means they're getting more intelligent, which means they're getting creepier. And I loved that moment.
Yeah. When that bit with the, when the doctor's instructing Donna to do that thing, then he goes and plays with a load of pipes. And then the duplicate arrived to speak to Donna. Did anyone, at what point did you clock that that wasn't the doctor?
Ah.
When they wanted me to.
Go ahead, James.
I was going to say when they wanted me to, as soon as, obviously, Donna appears in the doctor's space, that's when I clocked.
Ah, right, okay.
I was too late, so they knew by that point.
I clocked it before then, and the only reason I clocked it before then is because they did one of those classic TV and movie tropes that writing style that you just can't avoid. You know something's going on. When the doctor walked in the room and Donna wouldn't look at him, and she was like, I've got something to tell you. Oh, no, and before you stop me, it isn't and say anything. And I was like, oh, okay, he's not the doctor.
Yeah, same because here.
It's that writing style right there. Once the one character says, oh, before you interrupt me and say anything, it's the tone of voice that the actor's using, because you know the actor knows they have to distract the audience, and they don't do the actual, this is just a regular conversation David and I are having kind of thing. So I'm afraid that did give it away for me there. It didn't ruin it for me, because I sat there and went, oh, what's going on?
Yeah, what's going on? Yeah, 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 same here. But yeah, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the episode. I liked the robot and the whole slow-mo thing. That was really clever. And the whole idea that the station reconfigures in order to detonate was good. What was that spaceman creature, though? Looks like a new sort of... I thought maybe it was a Jadoon at first, and then I looked a bit more carefully. I felt maybe their neck was a bit too long.
They said in The Unbound that it's an equine race.
Oh,
they
right.
talked about the sort of the Sanskrit on the controls and how that had been designed on the theory that they would have hooves.
Right.
So the lines and the shapes and the dots that they used to make their alphabet were kind of the thought of how you do it if you had hooves. So I thought that was kind of interesting. So they'd have been an entirely new race.
Cool.
Which maybe we will see.
And speaking of that creature too, the doctor. So, okay. And this is, I'm not nitpicking here. This is just like, you know, when you sit there and you have actors say, nobody's seen anything like this story before or whatever kind of thing. I think that's a tall claim to make for anything. Forget about Doctor Who, any TV show, any movie. I don't think anybody's breaking barriers anymore because we've all kind of seen all of these kinds of things. And maybe I'm wrong. Maybe somebody will. But when you saw the pilot, when they said that she had been floating around the ship, she had created her own gravity around the ship, or was caught in the ship's gravity or something. I don't know if you guys have seen it. I can't remember the name of it. But there was a new TV show recently, the past year or two or whatever, starring Hugh Laurie, in a basically a spaceship that is like kind of a space cruise liner.
No, I haven't seen that.
And they get lost in space. They get thrown off course, and it's going to take them like millions of years to get back home, almost Red Dwarf kind of style. And one of the engineers that they need to actually solve the problem dies, and they do a funeral for them, and they put the casket out in space, but they didn't account for the fact that gravity was so messed up. So their entire 3 million journey back to Earth, the casket's just circling this one completely glass enclosed area. So they constantly see the casket just orbiting the ship, and it was a comedic point. It was a silly joke in that story. Whereas here it was used to with more weight and more gravity, or mavity, I guess. And I liked it, but I immediately thought back and I'm like, okay, did Russell see that? Or, you know, was it, and it's hard to say, like, was this something somebody thought of? Because people truly can have the same idea, and I know that. But when I saw that, I was like, this is so weird. I literally just saw this in another TV show.
There was a horse-like equine creature in the New Adventures, or the BBC Books Adventures, I should say, with the Eighth Doctor years ago, which I just, it was at the back of mine. As soon as James said that they were equine, I thought, hello, this has been done in one of the books. Which one was it? And it was in a book called Genocide.
Okay. I was also going to say Sophie Aldred's book.
All right.
That had equine in that one as well.
Oh, right, okay. Yeah. I was initially thinking of cows because there was that Doctor Who magazine comic strip when there was cows on the moon in spacesuits and the Fifth Doctor encountered them. And it was absolutely the worst thing that I'd read for years. I absolutely hated it.
Oh, yeah.
But it was one of those ones when they'd have like long runs of a single doctor and they'd break up with different doctors. And then it was just before they went into the Eighth Doctor stuff in Doctor Who magazine. So we're probably talking about 95, early 96 when they did that. I wasn't a fan of it. Wow. I mean, it's good to be kind of generally unanimous on an episode of Doctor Who, as I think we are. Just to dip into the overnight ratings, these don't matter, but they do in some cases. James maybe could just explain why it doesn't matter in a moment. Overnights for episode one was 5.08 million. Overnights for this episode is 4.83 million. I suspect with lots of amusing CGI and droopy mouths and big Kenny Everett style hands, the this one might gather a bit over the 7-day consolidation, a bit more than the last episode, who knows, or maybe they'll jump in to be roughly the same. James?
I mean, like I said last time, and I'm no voice of authority, but I would think for a show like this, which is playing very much of a as a gateway brand, which is obviously already got its nice deal with Disney for large global exposure, the overnights aren't going to carry, say, the big pressure as maybe a show which doesn't have that sort of brand connection to the BBC. I suspect that they're quite happy with where it's going at the moment, especially against the saturation of content which is out there, where it is very hard for the BBC to kind of puncture, especially in terms of drama. I think they'll be quite happy with it, I think. But again, like I said, we're not in the board meetings. Who knows?
No, sure.
No, I was going to say, it just depends really on what they are anticipating. It's like with anything, it's like with any sort of budget and costs. It's like, what were they anticipating as their return in terms of capture? And I would have been very surprised if they were thinking they were going to get rocketing vast numbers of people. I don't think it's like that.
No, but I don't either. But I am concerned because we're in a situation where, you know, the dance show does very well. And specific sporting events also do very well. You know, football matches, rugby, big crunch rugby games and things like that, they are still doing very well. Whereas dramas and drama launches, I mean, I felt it was a little bit clutching at straws in some way, saying the Doctor Who is the biggest drama launch of the year, when it's kind of like the end of the year and it's a show with a 60th anniversary and it wasn't a huge launch really. That's what they were saying after episode one. But I mean, it's basically that ratings these days tend to exist purely as a stick for the press to beat a specific show with, don't they? So,
well, that's it. I mean, and again, we've got to remember, like I said last week, that, you know, Doctor Who is now, and the way it's being modelled as a sort of multiple entry sort of network of shows. So you know, this will bring people to iPlayer to watch old Doctor Who. Doctor Who will refresh people into watching this. And, you know, the same sort of thing to some degree over the globe. Obviously, they don't have the iPlayer catalogue, but it's not just about the singular show anymore. And it's also about where that show is projected to go. And as you say, I mean, sports have always been massive. I mean, it's, you know, Fox made its empire on, as we said, you know, starting by drawing in sports into its content in its early days. You know, sports for Disney, you know, we saw last year the big drop Disney had in its revenue because it losing sports in certain areas of the world. You know, it wasn't about the Marvel stuff or the Star Wars stuff. You lose your way to distribute your sports to certain countries. That has a massive impact because it's a massive, massive business. And I think, again, we've all got to be careful when we sort of go, well, sports are doing well. The sort of live or, you know, live entertainment stuff, which has got massive catchment that anyone can watch at any time, doesn't require any massive investment, is always going to be water cooler moments. That is always going to do well. And we've known for years it's fought against Strictly and struggled.
Yeah.
Because drama does.
Okay.
But I suppose, and now it's also Outfarm. Now you've got a production company doing a lot of the stuff as well. So I think that probably helps the show more than if it was all entirely internal. In-house. But we'll see.
Yeah.
Before
we go on to ratings and, our own personal ratings, I should say, before we get onto that and look at the next episodes in terms of what we know from just the end of this episode, I just want to go back to the spaceship and the set, because there's clearly a lot of green screen stuff going on there, blue screen, whatever. Mm-hmm. But the smaller sets I thought were really good, the actual physical sets.
Yeah.
So you've got the cockpit, you've got the couple of corridors and the couple of side rooms. I thought they were really well designed. They look kind of unusual, very different to stuff seen in Dot 2 before. And, I mean, it might have been very easy to go in a completely different direction and make it all sort of retro. You know, Loki makes a big deal of the whole retro element of the H-quarters, doesn't it, of the TVA. But they didn't do that. They went for a very sort of very futuristic, very polished sort of appearance. I really, really like that design.
Yeah.
Well, and I think Doctor Who each week, you know, like, they have to... The TVA and Loki, you know, they need a look. They needed a look for that series. Yeah, that show needed a look, you know, every week, each week kind of thing. Doctor Who, you have to do every week. How do we make it look different?
Different, yeah.
And mind you, the one ship with the dividing barrier, the cockpit with the dividing barrier where the Doctor and Donna were facing off against their doppelgangers between the wall. I mean, that's the same set from the Star Beast when they did the same thing with the Doctor and Donna in the first episode. They just redressed it and reworked it. And that's, you know, that's movie making 101, really. They were great. It was, for me, I would say, as much as I loved the story, it was the long hallway scenes that I thought looked cool, but definitely looked fake. You know, like it just suffered from that. All you had was a floor, so you could tell you shot it entirely on green screen. And I know they used the previs shots, so they would overlay them into the shot so they could make sure they got angles right. But there's just something about it that doesn't always marry 100%. Did not ruin it for me. I am used to CGI looking that way, and I really liked the aesthetics of it. So I'm not complaining about it. It's just there's a certain reality when you're dealing with CGI. Sometimes it looks utterly invisible, and sometimes it looks noticeable.
Let's offer a rating. I'm pretty sure the last time you were here, Brian, we did a rating. We do them out of 10 for the episode. So as our guest, I'll let you go last. James, you're first.
I'm fine with that. I will give it a 9.
Okay, very high. I will also give it a 9. I very much enjoyed it.
Oh, I should have gone with 9.5. Maybe I should have gone with 9.5.
Brian, what about you?
Well, just to be different, I'm going to give it a 1. I actually, before either of you two spoke, I was going to give it a 9.
Okay.
On the basis that if they just didn't have that intro in the story, it would have been a solid 10 for me. Just the intro. Forget about the timeless child. And only on the basis that I didn't think the intro was necessary. That's it.
Sure. There's no quota on 9s. You can have a 9. It's fine.
I'm going to stick with the 9. Final answer.
Okay. The end of the episode brought back one of the most loved characters in Doctor Who, Wilfred Mott, played by the great late Bernard Cribbins. I share a birthday with Bernard Cribbins. Just thought I'd throw that out there. I've probably mentioned it before.
Just throwing that out there.
Yeah. It was very nice to see him again, wasn't it?
Yes. I think Wilf, when people talk about how much they love Wilf in the fan base, I do think it is not one of those exaggerated things. I think he is a character that resonated with pretty much everyone out there.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Except Power of Three. Power of Three didn't like Wilf at all. No one liked Power of Three.
Gosh, dang it. She's just... that darn Power
Such
of Three.
Such a prick, that guy. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it was great to see Wilf. It was great to see their reactions to Wilf. You know, it's really nice.
Yeah. The thing about Power of Three is... it was actually the one I was thinking of when I was having that conversation. The one with Stephen Berkoff. The one with this superb actor with immense range who's made a career out of playing psychos and villains. And you've got him in for about 2 minutes.
Honestly, that's I don't even remember you. I don't know who he is in the episode, so I don't even, like, there's the impact.
He's right at the. He's kind of right at the end where they go to the spaceship. But you know Stephen Berkoff, don't you? He's in Octopussy.
Oh wait, hold on.
He's the.
Don't look up anything about Power of Three. Just leave it alone.
he's the mad Russian general.
Guy. Oh my god.
Yeah, Russian general in Octopussy. Dude. Yeah, yeah.
I don't remember him being it. Well, then again, I don't remember that story much because I clearly don't.
Yeah, because it's in the bin.
It's in the bin.
It had its opportunity. Right. It had a good actor. It couldn't even be bothered to use him properly. All anyone remember about it is two dudes sitting on a sofa and another dude wandering around in the background complaining a lot, who was probably the doctor. No one's sure because they can't remember because no one's watched any more than half.
There it is.
There you go. There you go. Okay, so we leave Doctor Who with the world about to end and a jet airliner crashing into London and the Doctor and Donna landing there. And we know that the next episode of Doctor Who has a very famous guest star called... What's his name? Doogie Howser, really? MD. Yeah, he's in
it. That's it.
That's the guy. That's who Doctor Who's up against next week. Another Doctor. Only this one's a boy genius. what's his name?
Neil Patrick Harris.
That's right. As the toy maker. And that is the... I mean, in many ways, it's the kind of thing we've been looking forward to, isn't it? It's the episode we've been waiting for in many ways, because this is one that, you know, all the location shooting was done for. We've seen photos, set photos from it. So it's got a kind of an exciting element to it, hasn't it, in that regard?
You know, it's weird. I didn't realize that until you said it. It is the one that all the street photos and so on came from.
Yeah.
Or I would say the bulk of them.
Yeah. Wow. Definitely. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm particularly looking forward to that as well. And then presumably something's going to happen at the end of the next episode as well. Which we all know what's going to happen in that regard, don't we? We're all pretty much expecting it, so.
I don't know what you are getting at, actually. I am surprised.
Okay. We can wrap it up. That's the end of the podcast. Thank you, Brian, for coming back and chatting to us about Wild Blue Yonder. So thank you. Have you enjoyed being back?
Yes. You know what? To be quite honest, what I'm enjoying even more is enjoying the show again. And I don't say that to throw shade on the previous two eras. Like, I don't mean it that way. Because I think I've talked before. I like Jodie's Dalek stories. I liked the bulk of Flux. There are Ma Farrow stories. I loved Peter Capaldi. You know, like, there are things that I loved. But for a long time, I just felt the show wasn't resonating with me, and that's okay. That's Doctor Who. It has so many different eras. It's always going to resonate with different people.
Yeah,
I am enjoying walking into this and going, wow, you know what? I really like these. So I'm hoping next week keeps it going.
Yeah,
because it's been a nice feeling on my part as a Doctor Who fan for as long as I have been, to sit there and go, wow, this especially. I said that, you know, Moffat and Tennant said this one episode was so unique, it hasn't been seen before, blah, blah, blah. It really was a unique episode. I don't want to take away from that. So I really enjoyed how unique this episode was this week was.
Yeah. Anything about James?
So, yes, it's been great.
Yeah, I thought it was really good. I particularly liked how you have these creatures which can emulate you, not just physically, but mentally. So there's just no way around that. You know, if you did sort of put a mark underneath your shirt, it could read in your mind. You put a mark behind your shirt to identify you and create the mark itself. You know, there's so powerful that even at the end, they're so close. Donna's so close to a doppelganger, he doesn't know which is which. And I think that was a really powerful sort of, you know, creature to have in there for that one-off. And it worked. You never felt that was ever lost. You never felt they were weakened to make them, you know, beatable. You felt the tension. It was a lot of fun. It was slightly scary, but then, as you say, these crazy prosthetic arms and all that stuff. I think it was a nice example. Like we were saying last week, and we said the week before, you know, is Davis just going to go back to the blueprint that he's comfortable with, or is he going to try and push it a bit? I think this is an example that he does want to occasionally try and push it a bit.
Yeah.
But and play with it. And I think that's really enjoyable. That is, as Brian said, it's refreshing.
Excellent. Okay, well, that brings us to the end of this week's show. Thank you very much for joining in with us. We'll be back for another episode next week, and we're hopefully bringing a guest into the discussion once again. We haven't had any Facebook comments about the episode this time. I will try and organise things so we can have some input from the Facebook group as well next time. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.